Gutflix is the streaming platform for digestive health professionals. Discover curated GI content on IBD, hepatology, endoscopy, and more, as well as expert courses, UEG Week recordings, and podcasts personalized to your clinical interests. Start exploring at gutflix.eu. Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the UEG Podcast. It's Pradeep Mundra here, gastroenterologist and podcast host. Now, GI cancers are changing in various domains. Firstly, in the way they're being diagnosed and also how they behave during the course of their illnesses. However, probably the biggest change is in the prognosis of such cancers. And one big factor that has made in the medical oncological treatment of these cancers. Now, when it comes to gastroenterology, three important areas have seen a huge leap in the medical treatment. One is IBD, we all know. Obesity management is another, if you want to call it gastroenterology, and immunotherapy for GI cancers. Now, as gastroenterologists, most of us may not be fully directly involved in initiating medical oncological treatment for our patients, but I certainly know in some countries, and depending on the training, and some gastroenterologists are heavily involved in initiating such treatment. But we are certainly involved heavily in the journey of our patients with GI cancers, whether it is the diagnosis or some specific treatment delivered by gastroenterologists, but more importantly, in the management of any complications from any form of treatment, whether it is surgical, medical, oncological, or endoscopic. So knowledge on these things are important and inevitable for us to learn about these things. Now, immunotherapy is something that has probably revolutionized treatment of GI cancers lately. And in this episode, we want to discuss about this. We want to discuss about the basic concepts of immunotherapy and how it works, how immunotherapy has changed the outcome for our patients, I guess different roles of immunotherapy, whether in metastatic disease or locally advanced disease or an adjuvant treatment. Now, today's guest is Dr. Jeroen Dirkeville, who's a GI oncologist and also a gastroenterologist, a dual accredited at the Department of Gastroenterology at University Hospitals Leuven in Belgium. Jeroen is also an associate professor of oncology at Catholic University in Leuven, Belgium, and he's a clinical and translational researcher in the field of immunotherapy for GI cancers. Welcome to the UEG Podcast, Jeroen.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So, Jeroen, can you start by explaining when did the concept of immunotherapy start? How did the idea come to us in terms of treating cancers with immunotherapy?
Yeah, it's in fact a little history lesson, and it's quite interesting. So, more than 100 years ago, there were already some hints that the immune system was very important for cancer biology. And for example, there was this one surgeon in New York City working in Memorial Sloan Hospital. And he was observing together with some of his colleagues that, well, patients with cancer, with visible cancer, so for example, sarcoma, soft tissue cancers, that got infected with streptococcus, like severe infections, sometimes had spontaneous remission of those cancers. So together with the infection came a remission of the cancer. And he started wondering why would that be? And maybe it has something to do with the immune system. So he started to inject cancers as a treatment with some form of inactivated streptococcus mixture. And of course, this was a very rough form of immunotherapy, but he saw some remissions and some effects in those patients. At the same time, of course, there was a few decades later the emergence of chemotherapy and radiotherapy also as powerful tools to treat cancer. So this kind of approach was a little bit discarded back in the days by the colleagues. And it's only until quite recently, a few decades ago, that this concept of the immune system being important was readopted, so to speak, and that it was further explored. Because then at that time, we had more tools to look into the biology, of cancer. And what we, for example, learned is that, well, the immune system is indeed very important, that cancers, we know they are, well, genetic diseases. And so cancer cells have an aberrant DNA. They have mutations. They have other changes in their DNA, which make, of course, that they multiply very fast without control, that they can invade and they can metastasize. But also this aberrant DNA results in peptides, proteins that are foreign to the body and foreign to the immune system, so-called tumor neoantigens or tumor-associated antigens. And these are peptides that normally the immune system would recognize. And how it goes, what we learned in the 90s is that, of course, antigen-presenting cells, and this is a bit of biology, they would go to the tumor, they would find the antigens, they would take them up, they would traffic to the lymph nodes, and there present these peptides to the T cells, to the immune system, and the T cells, these naive T cells, which reside in the lymph nodes, they would then be activated and traffic through the blood vessels, infiltrate the tumor, find the cancer cells that are expressing the same antigens and attack the cancer cells, the so-called cytotoxic T cells, would then, of course, do their job and kill the cancer cells. And this is what we call very, very important concept in biology, the cancer immunity cycle. And this is what we learned over the decades, a very important role of the immune system in cancer surveillance and cancer control.
Okay, so it looks like our body is already equipped to kill these tumor cells. So I guess with the immunotherapy, you're kind of either guiding it or directing or making them more powerful.
Well, if the cancer immunity cycle would work perfectly fine all the time, then I would be out of job. That would be great, and I could do something else. And of course, a lot less suffering would take place. But, well, in order for a cancer, from a perspective of the cancer then, to become relevant and to become a disease, to indeed grow and metastasize and so on and so forth, the cancer needs to evade this cancer immunity cycle. And this is exactly what happens. And so the cancer has put in place all these brakes on this immunity cycle, on different parts of this immunity cycle. It can be the presentation of antigens. It can be the trafficking of T cells. It can be a block on the cytotoxic effect of the T cells. So there are many, many places in that cancer immune cycle that the cancer can put brakes. And immunotherapy is, very simply put, it is taking away as many breaks as possible to reinvigorate the immune system against the cancer, so to reactivate the immune system. And so you have many forms of immunotherapy, of course. And so, for example, what we have learned over the years is that chemotherapy and radiotherapy is probably also a form of immunotherapy. And probably in part, the effect that we see with chemotherapy is indeed immune-driven. And for example, you can have a so-called immunogenic cell death by chemotherapy, and more antigens are released by this cell death, and then the cancer immunity cycle can get a boost. And so it's not only the immunotherapy that we talk about with our patients and the new innovative drugs. These are very important, but probably in general for cancer treatment, immune system is very important.
Okay, so nicely explain how the cancer, the body's immune system work. Are there different ways in which the immunotherapy medications are developed? So are there different stages or different steps where you target this treatment?
So in general, if we talk about immunotherapy, we do not talk about chemo and radiation therapy. And so we talk about specific molecules. And well, it's all related to what we call the checkpoints. Yeah. The checkpoints are, in fact, one of these breaks on the cancer immunity cycle. And checkpoints are inherent to the body, and so we have them everywhere, and they are expressed on T cells. And when they interact with their ligands, these checkpoints, then the T cells are calmed down. And so they are not attacking, they are, in fact, inhibited. Yeah. And this is, in our body, a very important mechanism to prevent the immune system from becoming too active. But on the other hand, the cancer will abuse this mechanism, so to speak. So they will express these checkpoint ligands on the surface. Cancer cells will express the checkpoint ligands. They will interact with the checkpoints on the T cells, and the T cells will be inhibited. And this is one way of immune tolerance of the immune system towards the cancer. And one of the most important interactions there, now I'm naming some molecules, but is the interaction between PD-1, which is the checkpoint on the T cell, and PD-L1, the ligand, on the cancer cells and other immune cells. This interaction inhibits the immune system. And what we do with our checkpoint inhibitors, which are monoclonal antibodies that are directed against PD-1 or PD-L1, we try that this interaction cannot take place. So there is no interaction between PD-1, PD-L1, and so the T cells, they wake up, so to speak, and they have their cytotoxic activity. Another example, and the second most frequently used checkpoint inhibitor, is against CTLA-4. CTLA-4 is equally so a checkpoint, more important in T-cell priming, so in the lymph nodes, not specifically in the cancer, but it's the same principle. And so these drugs are now what we call, if we talk about immunotherapy in cancer, in GI cancers, for example, it is 90% of the time or 95% of the time we talk about checkpoint inhibitors. So it's not a personalized treatment. It is indeed infusions. Patients get them every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, every 4 weeks. It depends on the brand. And it is exactly that, monoclonal antibodies directed against those checkpoints or checkpoint ligands.
Nicely explained. So these checkpoints are overexpressed, so to say, in the cancer cells. So that would mean that they would interact with the T cells and prevent being destroyed. With checkpoint inhibitors, you are essentially inhibiting these so that they become more, so to say, they become more susceptible to being killed by a body's immune system, and that's how they work.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's great. So that's the new mechanism. So these are monoclonal antibodies. All of them are, like, they're not small molecules, anything like that.
No, that's not something that has been developed to clinical practice yet, no.
Okay, so these are new molecules. I'm assuming they've developed in the last many years. So what was the problems in the past with the previous chemotherapy agents in GI cancers? Why was there a need to change?
Well, there, I have to be clear that chemotherapy remains one of the very important pillars that we use in GI cancer treatment. Chemotherapy is specifically potent in what we call neoadjuvant or adjuvant setting, which is the treatment before or after mainly surgery. And there, chemotherapy is sometimes potent enough to kill remnants. For example, in the adjuvant setting, patient gets surgery for colorectal cancer. And for example, there is some microscopic remnant of the disease left. You don't see it on a scan, but it's there because that is in fact the source of a relapse and after a certain amount of time after surgery. And chemotherapy can sometimes eliminate, not in all patients, but sometimes eliminate that remnant. So in this setting, it really provides cure, extra patients that are cured with GI cancer. So again, a very important pillar. However, if we use chemotherapy in more metastatic setting, so with patients with metastases, active disease, it often results in a remission of the disease. So we can get the lesions under control, we can make them smaller, but it is very hard, if not impossible, to cure this disease, to completely eradicate every cancer cell that is there and to cure this patient and to go for a very long-term good effect. So that is, I think, the main problem. And this is because cancer cells get used to the chemo, they get resistant. And at a certain point in time, and this can be very fast, for example, in pancreatic cancer, which is notably quite resistant to any treatment, but it can be also after many years, like some colorectal cancers who are more susceptible to treatment. But in the end, people develop resistance to those drugs. And then, of course, it becomes a very, very difficult story. Also, chemotherapy, as we know, has quite some side effects and is affecting the quality of life of our patients. So there was certainly room for improvement. And with the checkpoint inhibitors, what we have seen, at least in some cancer types, and we can go into detail about that in a minute, but in some cancer type, which we call immune hot, these are probably the cancer types that have not so many breaks in the cancer immunity cycle. And so maybe just a few breaks, maybe just that last step of the cytotoxicity with the checkpoints. If you take away that one break, then you see sometimes dramatic effects. And now, for the first time, what we saw is really deep remissions and sometimes even cure in patients with metastatic disease, at least in those patients with what we call immune hot tumors. So tumors that do not have that many breaks in the cancer immunity cycle, and they only need that small push from the checkpoint inhibitor to really have that dramatic effect. So this was a revolution in oncology. And also in terms of side effects, it's a whole different story compared to chemotherapy. There are side effects and we can talk about that, but it's not the classical side effects that you see with chemotherapy, like hair loss, like anorexia, nausea, gastrointestinal toxicities for all patients, what we see with chemotherapy. It's a different, actually different story with immunotherapy.
Yeah. It's a different profile. So in summary, it looks like the differences or main thing that I picked up is that they, of course, work differently. That means the depending on the type of tumors, the efficacy can be amazing, even cure you're talking about. And the side effect profile is very different from conventional chemotherapies. Maybe we should delve into a little bit about the now that you're talking about efficacy, where have they changed? Where are these the game changers in which cancers, focus on GI cancers?
Yeah. So if we look to cancer type specific efficacy of immunotherapy, then probably one of the immune hottest tumor types there is in the GI field is primary liver cancer, hepatocellular carcinoma. So a bit surprising because this has been a very difficult to treat disease for many years. But we have seen with immunotherapies that at least a proportion of patients have very, and this is about 1 in 5 patients, have very, very deep remissions and long-term effect of immunotherapy. And we use immunotherapy in that disease as the only approach sometimes. And so this is one of the more immune-sensitive tumors. And then you have tumor types like, for example, gastric cancer or biliary tract cancer, which are still sensitive to immunotherapy, but not that sensitive. And in those cancer types, we will mostly use it in combination with chemotherapy. And so we did already use chemotherapy, and now we add immunotherapy to the treatment regimen for metastatic disease, for example, in order to prolong survival. And of course, clinical trials have shown this effect. So this is some kind of an intermediate immune-sensitive tumor type. But then you also in GI specifically have quite a lot of cancer types that are immune cold and where immunotherapy, unfortunately, today has very limited or no role to play. And for example, this is the case for the majority of patients with colorectal cancer, which have microsatellite stable colorectal cancer. We will go into microsatellite instability in a minute, but microsatellite stable colorectal cancer is the majority of colorectal cancers. And these are immune cold tumors with very limited efficacy of the current generation checkpoint inhibitors. And the same is true for pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma, so pancreatic cancer. Also there, we still have to use only chemotherapy with limited efficacy, as I said, but immunotherapy also there was tested in clinical trials and did not show any effect or any added value. So that's the spectrum of GI cancers going from very immune sensitive tumor types like squamous cell cancers, like liver cancer, to more intermediate to really immune cold cancer types where immunotherapy does not play a role today.
On that role, I'm sure some of us who sit at the MDTs understand these different terms, and I think some of us don't. So just can you briefly explain what is the difference between neoadjuvant treatment versus adjuvant treatment versus palliative treatment? I guess there's three different ways we use these drugs.
Yeah. So of course, the palliative treatment, I'm not 100% fan of that term. I rather use not curative or non-curative intent, we sometimes say, because of course we want to make cancer a chronic disease. And there are a lot of diseases which are not curable in medicine, and they're not necessarily treated with palliative treatment. So, but okay, it's nomenclature. It's not so important. So indeed, those are the patients with metastatic disease where we try to have the disease in remission, but we know we cannot cure it. When we go for a curative intent, it's often surgery as the mainstay of treatment still today. But then we use sometimes systemic approaches before surgery or after surgery to improve the chances of cure, to have more chances that the disease stays away. And for example, neoadjuvant is then before surgery and adjuvant is after surgery. And it's really typical in oncology that we are developing drugs first in that palliative or non-curative setting. And if we see an effect there, we probably then in a second phase move the drugs also to the perioperative space, so to speak. And this is exactly what happened with immunotherapy in GI cancers, also in non-GI cancers. And so what we saw is some effect or sometimes a very good effect in advanced disease. And then we learned that also in the perioperative setting, immunotherapy worked well. And that was very interesting. So what we saw in the adjuvant setting, we had some efficacy. But if we took the same drug and we put it before surgery, so in the neoadjuvant setting, it works even better. And we think that is because at the time of neoadjuvant, you still have the tumor in place, right? You still have all the antigens in the body, so the immune system can be trained against these antigens, while in the adjuvant setting, you only have this very, very limited remnant of disease left in the body. And so the immune system, well, has more hard time to recognize the antigen. So that's really why we are exploring more and more immunotherapy, immune checkpoint inhibition, sometimes in monotherapy, sometimes in combination with chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting. And gastric cancer, again, is the nicest example of that phenomenon. Maybe some of the listeners know the chemo regimen FLOT. You might have heard it during the MDT. FLOT is what we use already for many years, a combination chemotherapy for gastric cancer in the neoadjuvant setting before surgery. Now we have learned that adding a checkpoint inhibitor to FLOT will increase the efficacy and will increase the cure rate and the survival of patients with gastric cancer. Exactly that concept.
Excellent. Really nicely explained. It's really nice to understand the, when you know the science behind it, it sounds very fascinating. Now, you were talking about the colorectal cancers being cold immunologically or immune-wise, and you briefly mentioned about MSI plus. Can I kindly ask you to say what it means? What is MSI? What is plus or rich, MSI rich? How is it tested? And why is it important in your field, in the field of immunotherapy?
Yeah, so this is really an important concept. And again, at the MDT and also with early lesions that are sometimes taken away endoscopically, we will test for that. So it's indeed important that we go deeper into that. The correct terms are either deficient mismatch repair or DMMR or MSI high. So microsatellite instability high. They're not completely interchangeable, but I mean, for the sake of simplicity, I think we can use both terms to describe the same phenomenon. And so mismatch repair, the mismatch repair machinery is in all of our cells. And it's a machinery that is important to correct mistakes in the DNA, specifically mismatches, of course, mismatch repair. So mismatches are, for example, when a C is in front of a T in the DNA, that's not right. We know this from our lessons of cell biology. It should be C in front of a G. And so the mismatch repair machinery will repair that. They also will repair insertions and deletions, so small portions of the DNA that get lost or that get inserted. These are things, so this is a complex of proteins, this machinery that will scan the DNA and that will repair those types of mistakes. And now in some cancers, this machinery becomes deficient mismatch repair. And as a result, you can imagine that the whole tumor DNA, well, is pure chaos. There are a lot of mistakes happening and they're not corrected. So there are a lot of mismatches, there are a lot of insertions, there are a lot of deletions. Now, you can ask yourself the question, why does it happen in a cancer cell? Well, one example and most well-known example is patients that are born or people that are born with a germline mutation in a gene that encodes for a protein that forms this complex, this mismatch repair machinery complex. And for example, MLH1. If you're born with a mutation in MLH1, well, of course, already all of your cells have one copy that is dysfunctional. If you then lose the other copy in the cancer, the cell becomes mismatch repair deficient. Being born with a mutation like that is called Lynch syndrome. And this certainly rings a bell for many of the listeners. Lynch syndrome is indeed an hereditary syndrome, which of course increases the risk for colorectal cancer and other GI and non-GI cancers. And all the cancers that emerge in the context of Lynch syndrome are normally DMMR MSI high. 100% does not exist in medicine, but many, many, many are DMMR MSI high. Now, as a result, so I said that the DNA has a lot of mistakes, a lot of insertions, deletions. As a result, and what I told you in the beginning of this podcast, there will be a lot of antigens, right? The DNA will produce a lot of foreign peptides. All these antigens are very high quality. So the immune system, well, has a lot to play with, has a lot to recognize. And so these are, one of the most immune hot tumors out there, and if not the most immune hot tumor. So these are very sensitive to immune checkpoint blockade. And it's, as you understood, I think correctly, it is a phenomenon that we see not in one cancer type exclusively. And we can see it in colorectal cancer, but you can see it in gastric cancer, you can see it in endometrial cancer. And all these cancer types have a proportion of patients with DMMR MSI high. The problem is it's a small proportion. And so, for example, in colorectal cancer, metastatic disease, it's about 4%. So that's a very, very small proportion. Of course, colorectal cancer is a frequent cancer type. So we see from time to time, we see these patients. If in early stage disease, and for example, stage 2, stage 3 disease, the proportion is somewhat higher, 15%, sometimes 20%. But it is a minority of cancer patients. Nevertheless, we do not want to miss any DMMR MSI high case because we know we have a very good tool to treat those patients. So we test everybody with GI cancers, with some exceptions. Some cancer types, for example, hepatocellular carcinoma and squamous cells cancers, they are never MSI, so we do not test them. But all adenocarcinomas, pancreatic cancer even, although it's very rare in pancreatic cancer, we will test because we want to identify that needle in the haystack, so to speak. And how do we test? Well, there are multiple ways to test, but the most easy one, most cheap one also, is to do a staining in immune histochemistry for the four proteins that form the complex of the mismatch repair machinery, MLH1 and some others. You do the staining, and normally in the cancer, the staining, well, you see the protein light up. And so it's the expression is maintained, which means that cancer is proficient MMR or microsatellite stable. And so, for example, in colorectal cancer, we know that this is then an immune cold tumor, and these are the majority of cancers. If one or more of these proteins is lost in terms of expression, right, so there's no expression anymore, then, of course, we call it DMMR cancer. And then we know that immunotherapy could be a very potent drug. And of course, we use it in metastatic setting very much for these DMMR cancers. But we also learned that their neoadjuvant treatment with these checkpoint inhibitors for those specific cases can be very attractive. For example, in those cancers that emerge in very tough locations for the surgeon. You think about rectal cancer, for example. Rectal cancer is, of course, a place that, well, you want to keep your rectum. If you do a TME, so a total mesorectal excision, this comes with consequences in terms of quality of life, and in terms of stool habits, and so on and so forth. So what we do now is, if we see a DMMR rectal cancer, we will treat with immunotherapy. And in the majority, almost all patients that we do this, the cancer goes away completely. Without surgery, without radiation, without anything else. So just immunotherapy. And we can spare the rectum. We can go for an organ preservation. And this is, of course, very, very attractive. It's not so attractive in the right-sided colon because, of course, a right hemicolectomy is not so morbid. And it's quite simple procedure that is done by laparoscopy. So for those tumors, it might also be interesting. But rectal cancer, but also esophageal cancer, that is DMMR, or gastric cancer, these are the cancer types we look at when we think about organ preservation. When we think about using only immunotherapy when they're really sensitive to that and try to avoid all other options.
So it looks like a bit of game changer for a subset of the colorectal cancers. And you mentioned there about sparing the organs, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about that. But with regards to these subset of colorectal cancers, what sort of efficacy are we looking at? I think it's important for us to know, as gastroenterologists who may not treat these, so that it helps us to manage their other conditions as well. Just, I think, could you outline briefly in metastatic setting?
Yeah, in metastatic setting, it's a difficult question. Also, for communication with the patient, it's quite hard as an oncologist, and I will explain you why. Chemotherapy in most patients has some effect in terms of making the disease or getting it under control, putting it in remission. But as I said already, we get resistance early or later in the course of the disease. Immunotherapy is different. For example, if we talk about hepatocellular carcinoma, for example, which is one of the most immune-sensitive tumor types, well, we will have almost no effect in 80% of the patients. And then we will have these 20% of patients with a dramatic effect. So it's more black or white. Chemotherapy is more gray. Immunotherapy is more black or white. So it's possible that when we start immunotherapy, that we still can cure this patient, putting it really dramatic. But it's also possible that in 3 or 4 months' time, we will see liver decompensation due to tumor progression. And unfortunately, the patient dies from the illness. And so all these kind of scenarios, and we have to take into account when discussing this with the patient. So it's very, very hard. We have to take into account worst case scenario, but of course, we can also not ignore the fact that there's a possibility for the best case scenario. And also when it comes to the comorbidities and the other diseases, and should this patient still go to intensive care or should we have a DNR in place and should we discuss this with the patient? It's getting tough now, and because we used to know, okay, we do not have so many options. We will be always with our backs against the wall at a certain point in time with the disease that is not under control. So yeah, it's better to go for palliation and not for very, very invasive and hard procedures. Now we have always this kind of scenario in mind that it might still go very, very well with this patient, and we still have to put in efforts and to do everything we can to get through this very, very difficult time. So this really, it's very important that we have a very good communication between all healthcare practitioners involved in a certain patient case. For example, gastroenterologists, but also intensive care doctors, emergency departments, and so on and so forth, that everybody knows that, yeah, what is the best case scenario for this patient? What is the worst case scenario? And what is the sense of being very aggressive in terms of care?
Yeah, it's getting more and more complex. I guess if you're not fully aware of the situation, if you're not fully if you're knowledgeable about these things, it's best to talk to somebody, the oncologist who treats these things, before making any decisions, especially in terms of, you know, ICU care, DNR status, and what other diseases that we treat. Now, that's nicely explained, Jeroen. You briefly mentioning about the organ sparing in rectal cancer, and that's becoming increasingly important, I think. And we've made huge strides, especially in the endoscopic treatment field, where we are increasingly tackling early cancers or even slightly early advanced cancers with endoscopic route, as we know more about the residual disease risk and things. So, how is immunotherapy changing the organ-sparing approaches in the GI cancers?
Mm-hmm. So also there we have this really black and white situation. So you have the DMMR cases, which I already talked about, that are very immunotherapy sensitive, and we can use only immunotherapy with a very, very high chance of a complete remission and indeed organ sparing. And this has been published, I think, now 2 years ago in New England Journal of Medicine. It's, of course, not a randomized controlled trial because it works so well. You don't have to do this. I mean, you see these 30 cases that were treated this way with an anti-PD-1 antibody, and they're all in complete remission. So it's something that we very rarely see, I think, in medicine in general. On the other hand, you have the vast majority of rectal cancers who are proficient MMR or MSS. And here, immunotherapy, unfortunately, still has no role to play in the organ-sparing strategies and for these patients. Are they completely insensitive to checkpoint inhibition? Well, there's still a lot of signs going on. There is a little bit more activity of immunotherapy in the early setting compared to the advanced setting. Also in MSS colorectal cancer, we are learning this. Will it actually be practice-changing? Come into clinical practice, it's very uncertain right now. But of course, as you said correctly, organ sparing strategies, being it endoscopic resection, local excision, but also using combination of chemotherapy and radiotherapy to achieve clinical complete response and then follow up the patient with an active surveillance program. These are strategies, while they are not going away any longer, these are implemented in standard practice and show that indeed these conventional treatments like chemotherapy, like radiotherapy, also still have a very, very important role to play in these diseases.
So it looks like things are changing, and changing rapidly, with huge strides made in this direction. What do you think gives the future hold, or new developments and any novel therapies or any different direction of travel when it comes to an umbrella of immunotherapy at all?
So we now learned this cancer immunity cycle and taking away breaks in this cancer immunity cycle and the success we can have, at least for now, in a proportion of patients. So we are looking into taking away other breaks in this cancer immunity cycle to reinvigorate the immune system even more and maybe have better effects also in these so-called cold tumors. And one of the approaches could be to inhibit other checkpoints. This is now being reported in many trials. So there are other checkpoints besides PD-1, PD-L1 or CTLA-4, TIGIT, for example, VISTA, TIM-3. I mean, the names are not important, but there are many other checkpoints that are inherent to the body and that we can try to attack with monoclonal antibodies. This is one strategy, not for clinical practice yet, but something we are looking at. There are also other approaches of immunotherapy, which are not checkpoint inhibitors. For example, what we call T-cell engagers. What are T-cell engagers? T-cell engagers are molecules that bind to the tumor, to a certain characteristic receptor at the tumor site, and then also to a T-cell, like a CD3 binding, so a T-cell marker. So it brings together T-cells with the tumor and tries to, in that way, activate the immune system against the tumor. There are cell therapies. People might have heard of CAR T treatment. It's, of course, well known for hematological malignancies, where it's used in clinical practice. But also we are looking into these cell therapies where the principle is that we give an infusion to the patient of immune cells, modified, activated immune cells, which then, of course, should go to the tumor sites and attack the cancer cells. And the last branch of immunotherapy we're looking at are the so-called, well, vaccination strategies. This is already very old, but of course, it makes sense if we think that one of the problems that the immune system does not act against the cancer is antigen presentation. So the antigens of the tumor are not well presented to the immune system, so the immune system cannot act. Then it makes sense to think about a strategy where you put the antigens of the tumor in a vaccine, you vaccinate against it, the immune system gets presented with the antigens and goes in the whole body and attacks all the cancer cells that are expressing these antigens. And these approaches, which we think will mainly work in a very, well, limited disease setting, like adjuvant setting, for example, these approaches are now being tested in large trials using, well, the mRNA technology, which we have, well, now very much experience with, but thanks to the COVID pandemic, of course, and the whole technology is now completely worked out. And we use it to put in those vaccines, not COVID antigens, but tumor antigens. And of course, we'll have to see what the results are. For now, it's not definitive yet, but it's promising.
Sure, and thanks for explaining all that. And explaining all these immunological concepts really rekindled my interest in immunology. I was so much interested as a medical student. It's gone the other way since my gastroenterology career. Certainly looks like things are changing, and traditional concepts of, you know, chemotherapy may not hold good. And I think it's very important for all of us to understand that things are changing, and it's important to understand these things. If you do not know, it's important to talk to people who know about these things when we manage such patients. Any final thoughts, any take-home messages for us in the field?
Yeah, I think you really summarized this nicely. So communication between the different specialties who are taking care of patients with GI malignancies is very, very important. That we come from a time where there was, yeah, sometimes a little bit of nihilism towards cancer patients, that we say, okay, this is a cancer patient, so there's nothing left to do. And unfortunately, sometimes this is still the case. I mean, we cannot ignore that, and there's still a lot of work to do, but it's becoming more complex. And it's not because there is cancer in the file of the patient, even metastatic cancer, that the prognosis is necessarily very, very poor, or there are some unknowns at certain times. And so we need to be aware of the fact that there might be options for these patients, and that we still have to try our best to tackle all the problems that present themselves. And of course, we did not talk about side effects, and we can do this maybe in another podcast. But yeah, there are side effects of immunotherapy. Of course, all drugs have side effects, and you can imagine that the side effects here will be some kind of autoimmunity, because yeah, you take away breaks of the immune system, and they can present themselves, as many listeners will know, as GI diseases, which very much resemble IBD, for example. And so, yeah, that's another way or another message to my colleagues, gastroenterologists, that they need to be aware that there's a new disease spectrum even opening due to these immunotherapies. And if you see what the future holds with more immunotherapy, with taking away more breaks of the cancer immunity cycle, well, you know that we will have to pay the price in terms of more side effects for these patients as well. For now, they're manageable for sure, better manageable than chemotherapy side effects. But yeah, it's always an attention point.
Sharon, thanks for your time today, and I hope you have a lovely day.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Goodbye.
Cheers. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you've found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues. Enjoyed this episode? You can also find it on Gutflix, the streaming platform for digestive health professionals. Discover expert courses, UEG Week recordings, and podcasts, all personalized to your clinical interests. Visit gutflix.eu and start your GI learning experience.